It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios. Welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The Maduro regime is launching an investigation into opposition leader Juan Guaido, trying to freeze his accounts and prevent him from leaving the country.
There is a citizen that has practically led and organized all this action that is causing Venezuela's detriment.
National Security Advisor John Bolton tweeted the United States denounces the threats against Guaido and that, quote, there will be serious consequences for those who attempt to subvert democracy and harm Guaido. Nicolas Maduro, the disputed president, is pressing Guaido as the United States presses Maduro to yield power. This morning, the State Department announced Guaido now controls Venezuelan accounts at U.S.-insured banks, including the Federal Reserve Bank in New York.
What we're trying to do is to cut off the money to the regime that should not be in power and make sure that President Guaido has access to funds and has access to the assets of the country and to make sure we protect these assets for the people of Venezuela.
It's also an attempt to firm up Guaido's legitimacy and convince Venezuelan officials to abandon Maduro, especially military leaders who say they stand behind him. For his part, Maduro announced he plans to strengthen the nation's armed militia in response to growing tension with the United States. About 24 countries have joined the United States in recognizing Guaido as Venezuela's interim president. American adversaries China, Russia, and others back Maduro.
We expect the attempts by Cuba, Russia, and to some extent China, to prop up the Maduro regime's security or financing will lead to additional efforts to exploit the situation in exchange for access mostly to Venezuelan oil.
Russia has invested billions in Venezuela and remains critical of U.S. sanctions against Maduro and backing of Guaido.
Sandy Rios with you. That was not a current report. That actually happened in January. And, of course, we have talked a great deal about what's happening in the struggle over Venezuela. Nicolas Maduro has been in power for so many years, and the people are now so impoverished. I think they have like 1,000% inflation.
10 million
inflation. 3.7 million people have fled the country. People are losing an average of 20 pounds. I have lost an average of 20 pounds. They're starving. It's just an amazing situation. We'll give a fuller description in just a second. But a lot has happened since January, and I've asked Dr. Paul Coyer to join me today in studio to talk about this. Paul, you will remember, is a research professor at the Institute of World Politics. He's an associate professor for the French Army's equivalent of the West Point. He's also an author of a new book, which we want to talk about in a second. It's Sovereignty, Democracy, and Liberty. And he joins me this morning. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
The thing that he didn't say about you, it seems like maybe your mic needs to be up just a little bit, Grant. The thing that I didn't say was that Paul is married to a beautiful Venezuelan girl. I know she's beautiful. I haven't seen her, but I'm sure she is.
She is.
I've never seen a Venezuelan girl who wasn't beautiful, to be honest with you.
Very good point.
Yeah. And she's tell us about her musical background, because she's incredible.
Yeah. Marjorie was Venezuela has this thing called El Sistema, or the system, that started under a guy named Abreu in, I think, 1973 to focus mostly on people from poor areas, but also just Venezuelan children in general that wanted to have a background of the arts and want to learn and maybe be trained up to do a whole career in classical music. And Marjorie was middle class, raised by Cubans that had fled Fidel, so she wasn't from a barrio, but nevertheless, she grew up through that system to a degree. She's the same generation as Gustavo Dudamel, who's a conductor of the LA Philharmonic. They were both teenage violinists together in the system.
That must be a very small group, teenage violinists.
I mean, Venezuela, they really do prize classical music there because of the system. And so the arts are very important to them, which is one of the reasons why I love Venezuelan culture. But Marjorie now has multiple graduate degrees, including a doctorate from Catholic University of America here in Washington. She just last night was the guest concertmaster for the Apollo Orchestra here in Washington for a big concert they had with Metropolitan Opera singers flown in and English National Opera singers. It's,
wow.
She loves what she does. Paz and I enjoying her performances.
Well, as fine a musician as she is and as much as a scholar as you are, Paul, the thing that's really remarkable about both of you is that you have been really involved even personally in what's happening in Venezuela. I know that her parents are from Venezuela. Was she born there also?
Yes.
Yeah, so it's a country that's very dear to them. And lately, you guys have actually been protesting at the embassy here. Can you tell us about that and what's going on with that? Because that's a big story that nobody knows.
It is. I've forgotten exactly how many weeks, but approximately 2 months, or maybe slightly more, there was a kind of a strange amalgamation and group of several different left-wing, very radical protesters, some of which were just overtly Marxist. One of the group's names was called Code Pink.
Oh, yes, we are.
I'm
most
sure
people
that
pay
them.
Attention know Code Pink. Medina,
something or other.
Yeah.
Yes, I met her in D.C. once. I was not impressed. Yeah. And another one was called Hands Off Venezuela. Interesting, they were concerned only about American hands, not Hezbollah, Iran, Cuba, Russia, China, Turkey, et cetera. And several other groups of similarly strange names.
So you're there protesting.
We had hundreds of Venezuelans that were pretty much 24/7 around the embassy for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Protesting in favor of Guaido.
Democracy and Juan Guaido, who was the interim president, but not so much him as just democracy in general.
Okay.
And of course, the people that were inside were almost all lily white gringos that were pretending to occupy the Venezuelan embassy in defense of quote unquote people of color. Even though they were all whiter than I am, and I'm pretty white, I'm from Minnesota, and they were claiming to defend it against people of color and against quote unquote American imperialism, and defending a democratically elected president by which they referred to Nicolas Maduro. That takes a special kind of stupid to think that he's democratically elected. So we had, like I said, hundreds of Venezuelans around there 24/7 for weeks on end. Venezuelans right, left, and center. These were not all conservatives or libertarians. These were some on the left as well, and they were enraged by this. And some of them were so sharp, these Venezuelans would argue or try to start debates, not a violent argument with these Code Pink and Hands Off people, and say, can you explain, please, what you're doing, the logic of it? And, of course, there was rarely ever any response. Mm-hmm. So that was resolved about 3 weeks ago now when the Trump administration made the decision that legally they had the right to kick these people out as trespassers of a foreign embassy.
Were they staying 24/7?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
yep.
My goodness.
And so for a while, these Venezuelans outside the embassy, they had encircled it and they had reached that they had kept all water, food, et cetera, from going into the embassy to sustain these Marxists and these Code Pink people. And the Code Pinkers, of course, explained how draconian that was. And the Venezuelans said, you guys want to show solidarity with real Venezuelans and live like real Venezuelans. We have no water, no electricity, no food. Don't complain. So it was
very
a bit
interesting.
Of
and no coverage on the news. This is the first.
Very little.
The first I've heard about this, Paul, except from reading what you sent me.
Right.
No, nothing about this. And is there any reason to believe that Code Pink and this other group were funded by Maduro?
Oh, that, of people? Course. There's documentary evidence of it. Yep.
Yeah,
so and some of the leaders of these groups also had ties to Vladimir Putin, I might say.
Wow. So they're occupying the Venezuelan embassy here in D.C.
Correct.
You guys are going out there with all the other Venezuelans. You married to this Venezuelan who loves her country and her parents, and you're protesting with them on behalf of Juan Guaido, who is actually the
constitutionally president of Venezuela.
Yeah.
Right.
And so then how did that happen? So the Trump administration orders Code Pink and the other Marxists to be taken, purged from the embassy. How did they do that? And did you watch that? Did you get to see it? Or?
Well, it took place at about 11 o'clock one morning about three or four weeks ago, and I was working from home that day. So I did watch it on Twitter. They had a feed from our Venezuelan friends that were outside. They were live streaming it. And they sent Secret Service and police inside to escort them out and tell them they were being charged with trespass. So they came out. But they came out in...
So it didn't look like Julian Assange where they dragged them and their hair was all grown out.
No, that would have been fun to see.
Yeah, well, I know.
That's what happened.
Oh, it's good for the goose, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, all right. So are there protests still going on there? I mean, is there...
At the embassy, no.
Okay, because that's kind of the problem with
solved. Not that I'm aware of, to be honest. I have not been there for a couple of weeks. I've been busy with other things. There may still be some Code Pink and other people, a few of them outside screaming slogans. I have no idea.
I'm curious about the personnel in the embassy. Are they made up of the Maduro government or the Guaido government?
Oh, no, no, no. The Guaido government now has legal control of the embassy.
Oh, because the president, because the United States recognized
him. Correct. The Maduro people left about two and a half months ago, and they're the ones that gave the Code Pinkers the quote-unquote right to sit in the embassy and to occupy it.
I'm doing things a little backwards, Paul, but just I just read this morning or yesterday that there was a real turning point, that Russia has sort of withdrawn some of its support from Maduro in some form or fashion. Is that okay? I'll have to, we'll look into that. But yeah. That was a shot in the arm for Venezuela, I think, this morning. But you have said that besides the United States, there are like 20-some countries, something like that, Western countries that are supporting Guaido.
54, but it may be more. I spent 54 for several weeks, but that number,
okay.
I think,
okay.
is going up.
Give us an idea. I mean, like notables on that list and notables who aren't on that list.
Well, notables that aren't on that list, that's a good question. India, who is supposed to be a strategic ally in the newly renamed Indo-Pacific.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, India is, and that's a whole other discussion, the rise of India in the global stage. And they have to show their independence, even though they're aligned with us in strategically in important ways. So they haven't yet. Italy has been a bit problematic. And as you can see here from this book, I have a lot of links to Italy. There's some wonderful people there. But the party that is the dominant party in the ruling coalition has unfortunately been too pro-Russia, too pro-China, and has likewise really hedged its bets and not wanted to de-recognize Maduro. So a number of countries have not. Of course, the usual rogues gallery, Turkey, China, Iran, you know, Cuba, North Korea,
yeah.
great actors in the world, et cetera. Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, Evo Morales in Bolivia. The countries that have include, of course, Britain, you know, most of the EU.
Really, most of it. I was going to ask you about Germany.
Yeah.
Since Angela Merkel's kind of declared us as kind of on their, she lumps us off with.
We have a lot of tensions with Germany right now.
Yeah,
yes.
Boy, that's the truth. With Iran and Russia, she's put us on the list of, you know, we're the suspects along with them, which is pretty amazing.
She's a whole other discussion.
Yeah, really, that's true. It is true.
But Japan, okay. 54, that encompasses a lot of countries. And these are the countries that are the democratic countries of the world. These are the countries that are really our chief allies in sustaining the international order that's American-led.
You know, that's amazing, Paul, because when you think about it, the discussion and the talking point is that President Trump is not leading internationally. He's doing nothing. I just heard this from some politician yesterday, and because of your European expertise, I don't know how many languages you speak, but certainly French, and probably some Spanish, I'm guessing, and you spend a lot of time in Europe. In fact, this book that we mentioned that you've contributed to is called Sovereignty, Democracy, and Liberty, and you just actually lectured in Milan about this. I just say a word about that. Who were you talking to, and what was the kind of the nut of your conversation, your talk?
It was a group of several hundred government officials, academics, and senior jurists from around Europe, both the EU and non-EU European states. And they came together to discuss the issues of vital importance to the future stability of the EU integration project, that is the rise of nationalism, the national identity, sovereignty, and where does that all fit in to European integration? And I spoke specifically on American-European relations in that context, and the rise of Donald Trump, and the rise of nationalism, et cetera. So
was that before the elections of the EU or after?
Yes, it was actually just before Christmas. It was 6 months ago.
Oh, all right. Well, go ahead and tell us why. Then lots has happened since then with the EU elections.
It has, but my argument remains the same, and you know, I think it's still just as relevant. I argue here as well as I do in a chapter that's coming out in a book by National Defense University Press sometime this summer, called Strategic Military Ethics Primer, and my argument is in this book on military ethics because the international order and its stability is important to all of our security. On nationalism, that nationalism should not be a dirty word. It's simplistic to make it akin to fascism. There are negative forms of nationalism, just like the human spirit and the human nature is flawed, and we all have negative impulses as well as positive impulses within us. The same thing is true of nations. And so I argue that nationalism should not be condemned blanketly as if it's akin to fascism. Identity is important for any people. And if you deny them their identity and say you need to be, for instance, in Europe, part of a European identikit personality and ignore the fact that you're Italian, French, Castilian, whatever. That's going to lead to chaos and a crumbling of political support for a European project.
Paul, we're going to finish that on the other side of the break. But I just talked to Katie Hopkins in London about the European Union elections, which really bear out the reason why they probably ask you to come and talk about that, because the populists, the nationalists, are winning in almost all the countries of Europe right now, and they have a serious problem. When we come back, we'll finish that discussion. We'll also go back to Venezuela and talk about what is happening there now. Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Why have you stopped short of calling Maduro of Venezuela a dictator?
I think it's fair to say that the last election was undemocratic. But there are still democratic operations taking place in that country. The point is, what I am calling for right now is internationally supervised free elections. And I do find it interesting that Trump is very concerned about what goes on in Venezuela. But what about the last election that took place in Saudi Arabia? Oh, there wasn't any election in Saudi Arabia. Oh, women are treated as third-class citizens. So I find it interesting that Trump is kind of selective as to where he is concerned about democracy. My record is to be concerned about democracy all over the world.
Presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, the socialist who uses Venezuela as his, wonder who uses Sweden as his example of socialism and how wonderful it is, trying to answer the question of why he doesn't think Maduro is a dictator. Paul, I just let you respond to that. Instead of me, tell me what you think about that comment.
Well, pretty much everything he said in there, I could take major issue with. One is, you can tell he hedged on, he was asked, why do you not call Maduro a dictator? He didn't give an answer.
That's right.
He just
stalled,
dodged and said, well, I think it's certainly true that the last election was maybe questionable. No, all the elections have been questionable. And I had previously assumed that maybe Hugo Chavez's initial election in 1998 was legitimate, but I've been talking increasingly to politically active Venezuelans daily. I'm in touch with them down there. And they've been telling me that there is significant evidence that in 98 that was fraudulent as well. There was a significant public outpouring of support for him in that context, which is why he got elected. But fraud was also part of it. But certainly every election after that was outright fraud. So it wasn't just the last election. In terms of him pointing to Scandinavia, you're right. The supporters of socialism here in the United States always point to Norway, Sweden, Denmark. You can say a lot about that. Number one, in Norway, for instance, they have oil. Which allows them to support the very small population, just a few million people, with a vast social welfare system. They can afford to do it because they have that income of the oil. Denmark, as another example, has actually a freer free market system than the United States when you look at it in terms of lack of the number of regulations, burdensome regulations on business, and corporate tax rates. So socialism meaning state control of the economy? No, the Scandinavians don't have that. That's generally why they have
they still have a free
economies.
Market.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, I think it's in the article that you wrote for Providence magazine, and you tracked what's happening in Venezuela. And honestly, I do want to get into the details of that. But you also talk about what Hugo Chavez ran on, what his platform was when he first ran. Can you sort of recap that for us?
Well, I think it's really important for people to realize that Hugo Chavez didn't come out of a vacuum. Venezuela had a series of military dictators, a typical banana republic in a lot of senses in the early 20th century. And they finally got rid of one of those in January 23rd, 1958, which is why Juan Guaido chose January 23rd of this year to take the oath of presidency on the street. It was very laden with meaning that day, January 23rd. So January 23rd, 58, there was a coup. It was a good coup. It got rid of the military dictator, and it installed a civilian government with military help. Sometimes that does happen. And they rewrote their constitution, which was finalized in 1961. They had about 40 years of democracy. It wasn't a perfect democracy. No democracy is, because it's made up of humans, not angels. Through the 60s, 70s, and into the 1980s, their economy was growing by leaps and bounds. There were migrants from immigrants all over the world. starting in the early 80s, oil prices started to tank. In the 70s, remember, they had been shot up through the oil embargo, OPEC, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Venezuela benefited from that significantly. Its economy benefited. 1980s, prices went down.
And it was like the richest country in South America.
It was the richest country in South America. And in the aftermath, a decade or so after World War II, was the fourth richest country in the world by GDP per capita.
Wow.
Now, part of that measure is because the rest of the world was devastated by the war. But nevertheless, yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah.
So 60s and 70s, it grows like crazy. Starting in the early 80s, it starts to have problems economically because of oil prices that are low. But that wasn't the end of the world. They're still doing fairly well. But corruption was growing more and more to the fore. And you had two primary parties that, for most of that democratic period, ran Venezuela. Acción Democrática, Democratic Action, obviously, and COPE. President Carlos Andrés Pérez was forced out of office in May of 1993 due to corruption. That kind of symbolized the concerns that a lot of the country had. And Hugo Chávez had tried his coup against that government the year before and come to national prominence, arguing against corruption. So corruption was a big deal. Pales in significance to what it is now, but it was a big deal. So in that context, Hugo Chávez rises saying, I'm going to get rid of corruption, which, of course, we now know was laughable. He did exactly the opposite. He institutionalized it far more effectively than his predecessors had. But he said he would get rid of it. He said he would deal more transparently, which was the opposite of what he did. He said he believed in democracy and delivering power to the people, when in fact he accumulated increasing amounts of power in the state. He said that he was going to help the poor, and we now know Venezuela has more poverty than any other country in Latin America, and one of the most poverty-stricken countries in the world. And in terms of lack of transparency and corruption, I think it runs behind now each of the Central American states and numerous others that are world famous for being incredibly corrupt. Venezuela is worse than those in Transparency International's gauge.
So, Paul, correct me if I'm wrong here. Chavez, toward the latter part of his reign in Venezuela, he basically nationalized all the businesses. He moved to an outright socialist dictator, mm-hmm. but he wasn't that before. Is that fair to say?
He started accumulating power immediately, and you could see him begin to gradually undermine democracy from the beginning. It just took...
Which was the Cuban model.
Which
I remember
the
Sao Paulo Forum, where it said, don't stop taking over by, military fight and might, do it through the constitutional process.
Correct.
Take over the banks, take over the industry. And
gradually
then
they took it over.
And change the Constitution.
And he did change the Constitution, yes.
Yeah.
And so so you're right. It was a gradual process, but you could see it from the beginning. And so you had the Roman Catholic Church, for instance, and other key constituencies that said that this isn't right. My wife's parents, they had fled Fidel. They were Cubans. She was adopted and raised by Cubans in Venezuela. And they said, we have seen this story before. This does not end well. We know his pretty sounding words. He's going to help the poor. He believes in greater
equality, fairness.
Socialism is defined as, according to him, helping the poor, helping your fellow man, et cetera, et cetera. And we hear the same thing from American socialists.
Yes, we do, like Bernie Sanders.
Exactly. And mm-hmm. so Marjorie's Cuban parents said, this is BS, basically. We've heard this before. He says this. It's not what he means. This is what's going to happen. We're going to end up with a dictatorship and a police state. And that, of course, is what happened. It just took a few years to unfold.
So now, and then, of course, Chavez hands it over to Maduro, the bus driver, his right-hand man, and it's only gotten worse.
Correct.
So, and to sort of flesh that out, Paul, describe for us what you know is happening on the ground there now. We've done this before, and, you've introduced me to other Venezuelans who've talked before, but my understanding is it's just gotten worse.
It has, yes. You mentioned the weight loss, for instance. In 2016, this is a study that was done by Venezuelan NGOs and universities. The average Venezuelan lost an average of 19 pounds. 2017, they lost an average of 24 pounds. That's 43 altogether. In 2018, we don't have the stats yet, but I dare say they're about the same. Venezuelans call this the Maduro diet. They try to make light of it because otherwise it's too tragic to really think about in depth. But people are dying of malnutrition, especially children and infants. Where the biggest cause of death right there in Venezuela right now is among infants is malnutrition. And I'm not sure whether it's number two or number three beneath that, but in terms of the stats. But they're also dying from just lack of
medicine.
Antibiotics and medicine. Exactly. And they're dying in the hospitals. The hospitals are, you see pictures of what passes as hospitals, and it's horrific conditions.
So no medicine, and they can't get care, and so the death rate, we don't know. I mean, the records are not kept, so we really don't know. But I'm curious about this. That 3.7 million people have fled. In a case like that, Paul, would you say that that 3.7 would be those that might have had the resources and the, what are resources, whether it's financial or other, to actually do something if they had stayed, so that the people that are left are the weakest of the Venezuelan population?
The people that are left now are the weakest of the population, or are the poorest of the population, and they're the ones who are being victimized the most, which, of course, puts the lie to Chavez and Maduro's claim to help the poor. You are right that the people who have left, that started leaving, the first waves of people were the people that were the most educated, the most had the most money, that had the most skill sets that were, you know, that were prized by Venezuelan society, have gotten out quickest. Now you have those that have no means, that are trying to get out by jungles and river crossings, which are controlled by colectivos in most cases, that bribe
everybody. And that's the Cubans, right?
Colectivos are a mix of, well, they're mostly Venezuelans, but they're also trained by and assisted by Cubans. I've heard some Iranian presence there. I don't know for sure. But colectivos are some Cubans, but mostly Venezuelans, and they're armed thugs. Maduro has let a lot of these prisoners out of prison, talking murderers, rapists, armed robbers, et cetera. And he lets them out and says, you need to defend the state. You need to defend my regime. And that's the kind of people that
are
out
there right
now.
So they just prey upon the people.
Exactly.
Yeah, I just read an article this morning, Paul, about the whatever you call them, whatever class, it could be them, it could be the others, whatever other criminals, whatever the class of criminals, they're complaining now that they can't use their guns as much because they waste their bullets and they're harder to get, and that they also risk losing their guns because if the police apprehend them, they take the guns. There was one on camera. His face is disguised, but he was complaining about how bad it is. Now, I guess there's not as much to steal either. And as a matter of fact, and also concurrent to that report was that there are less killings now because, well, I guess the criminals are running out of bullets, so it's sad for everyone. Isn't that sick?
It is.
It really is very sick. And the average Venezuelan, as I understand it, earns $6.50 a month now.
I'm surprised it's that high. I don't think it's that high.
Really?
Yeah.
All right, so what's happening in the political scene? Because Guaido, you know, there's this big stand down a couple of weeks ago, and then honestly, I don't know what happened between Maduro and Guaido. He's got all of these 50 Western countries mm-hmm. supporting him. Mm-hmm. And but Maduro is hanging on. I mean, he's doing very well, and I'm sure he's supported by the Cubans, the Russians, mm-hmm. the Iranians. Mm-hmm. What's your perspective on this standoff? Do you see any gains by Guaido?
There have been a lot of gains since January 23rd. I think my opinion is he took a step back or so with the agreement, with agreeing to sit down with them in Oslo. I think that was a big mistake. He gave away some of his political legitimacy. The people of Venezuela that are left there had supported him so strongly because he showed physical courage. He went out on the street and he was willing to confront the government. And by sitting down with an illegitimate, dictatorial, basically criminal cartel, which is what Maduro's regime is, in Oslo, it lent them legitimacy they don't deserve.
So it was disheartening to them.
It was disheartening. I mean, the people that I've been talking to down there have been saying, we love Guaido, but we really are disillusioned that he did this. There is no negotiation with the devil, and that's how they see Maduro. You just don't negotiate with people like that.
Wasn't one of Juan Guaido's right-hand men arrested a couple of weeks ago?
Several of his have been arrested. It seems like every week or two, somebody around him either defects or is arrested.
So, do you think that they're are they still arrested? Are they still, you know, being held? You think?
I don't know.
I know you don't know.
I don't know.
But I mean, those kinds of things are so demoralizing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Guaido, I think the larger point that's relevant to what you're saying here is Guaido is in a position now where, yes, he's holding on, but he's not in a good position nevertheless. I mean, he doesn't know who he can trust. He thinks he can sort of trust the Cubans and the Russians and the Chinese. They don't care for, talking about Maduro. Maduro, that they don't care for Maduro. They don't care if he lives or dies. Putin, when he basically, according to Secretary of State Pompeo, ordered Maduro not to leave the country in the evening of April the 30th, Putin doesn't care if Maduro takes a bullet, which he probably will if this continues. He just wants to be able to put his finger in the eye of the United States. And it's the same thing with his Cuban overlords. They want to keep control of the mechanisms of the state. They don't care if it's through Maduro or anybody else. So Maduro doesn't know who he can trust. He has maybe 5 or 10 at the most people, I would suspect, around him that he can trust. He's holed up every bit as much as Guaido is. In Miraflores Palace. It's not like he, you know, has massive support in the country. Nobody supports him.
But Venezuela, I'm assuming, still has the same incredible oil reserves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so there's a lot at stake there.
They can't extract them because when Hugo Chavez came in, and I think you read this in the first article I wrote for Providence on April 26, when Hugo Chavez came in early 90, when he was elected in late 98, Venezuela was producing, I think, about 3.5 million barrels per day. Now, at the March numbers were 732,000. Oh. I think that stayed about static in April. I'm not sure what it did in May, but it's certainly not going to go up. So it went down by 80%. And the reason why is because Hugo Chavez, incredible mismanagement, and he wanted socialist supporters in control of PDVSA, the state petroleum company. So, and it was one of the most well-respected petroleum companies in the world. It was truly professional, a global giant. Everyone respected their engineering and other and management expertise. He purged all those managers that were so internationally well-respected, purged the engineers and replaced them in several different waves with people who he knew would be loyal. And then he gave control of it to a general who knew nothing about oil extraction. And so, and at the same time, he took the monies that he was getting in terms of international oil sales, the profits, and he didn't invest one cent of that back into upkeep of the equipment so that you can keep production high. He spent it on his socialist spending priorities.
But bottom line, the reserves are still there. And so there are reasons why Cuba and Russia and Iran, besides a thumb in the, or a finger in the nose or a finger in the eye, at the United States, there's also money at stake and big oil reserves, I would think. So when we return, Paul, we'll talk a little bit more about Venezuela, but I want to actually get into the broader issue that you began with in this conference you had in Europe about national sovereignty and, you know, people's pride in their own countries, mm-hmm. because that's a huge issue here. It's a huge issue there. So let's talk about it. Sandy Rios in the morning. Paul Collier is my guest, by the way. We'll put his article, Venezuela, a Country in Crisis, on our Facebook page. Be right back after this. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
The only way to have free elections today, truly free, which, by the way, we do not validate the elections from May 20th of last year. We need to have a new electoral council so we can have true institutions that can actually guarantee participation for all stakeholders, for all parties.
That was Juan Guaido through a translator, and he is the constitutional president of Venezuela, but he's having to fight for that. Nicolas Maduro maintains power, and the people are starving and not getting medical care. It's just a horrible situation. Paul Collier is my guest. Of course, again, Paul is a writer for the Institute of World Politics. He's a research professor. He's not just a writer. He travels in Europe a great deal. And one of the things that you write about, Paul, is the spiritual kind of climate in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. In fact, you have this great piece that you had a conversation with the chief rabbi of Venezuela. Say a word about that.
Pincus Brenner, he is an amazing guy. He's 88 years old, but he reminds me a bit, for fans of old cinema, of Eli Wallach.
Oh, yes.
In his older years. Yes. Just a kindly old guy that's just amazing. He is, and he doesn't come across as 88. He comes across as a really fit 60. Whip smart. It was an amazing, I keep in touch with him on a regular basis. So he lives in Miami now. He has since 2011. As you probably read in my article, the Jewish population there has shrunk from about 25,000, which in Venezuela, which it was when Hugo Chavez came to power, to about 5,000 today. And that, again, was mostly because of the growing push to inculcate an anti-Semitism that hadn't previously existed in Venezuelan society on the part of the Chavez government, because it was aligned with Iran and Hezbollah.
Yeah, so, I found that really interesting. You trace what he says. I read it, very interesting, that there were Jews in Venezuela long, 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 long time
hundreds
ago.
Hundreds of years ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he said, but then there was an influx after World War II for all the reasons we know.
Correct.
And he said that Venezuela was so tolerant of other people and other faiths. And
it's
that
one of the reasons he loves the country and why it became his adopted home. He felt so at home there.
And as you just said, that began to change when Maduro, or maybe it was Chavez, started working with Iran and Hezbollah.
Chavez, yeah.
Yeah. And so then, obviously, anti-Semitism, they had to turn up the burner on that. So are there any Jews left there now?
Yes, there's about 5,000. Okay. They still have all of their civil society organizations, like Club Hebraica in Caracas, and their schools. And they are functioning as well as they can in the current situation and trying to help the needy in their society as much as they can. So Rabbi Brenner tells me that, the day after, when democracy is restored there, that the Jews are have everything ready to be able to contribute significantly as well. And whether the Jewish emigres and expats that have left over the last 10, 12 years come back or not, the ones that don't come back, that stay stationed in Colombia and the U.S. and Canada, wherever they have moved to, they will certainly come back on short-term bases to help rebuild. They're just dedicated to that country.
You know, Paul, I'll tell you what makes me sad. It seems to me that I'm sure there are exceptions, but as I reflect on these despots who have taken over various countries of the world and devastated the population, taken away any kinds of weapons for self-defense, and who've implemented some sort of a dictatorial rule, they almost always prevail. I mean, I think of Cuba. You know, there was some effort to help Cuba, the Bay of Pigs incident, and all of that, and Castro prevailed, and the people have suffered for
these
decades.
The key is you always have to weaken the people one way or the other, make them defenseless, and then divide them and get them squabbling among themselves if you can.
Yeah.
That's a regular tactic.
And Iran, too, and I think of China, the Tiananmen. I mean, it's like these brutal dictatorships they use their power brutally. And so normal people can't really respond with that kind of brutality. Mm-hmm. And there's not much of a defense against that.
That's true. For people who have a sense of decency, you don't want to respond in the same way.
Right. And so brutality seems to win. And that's what makes me sad. I mean, Venezuela really is, I suppose there's still hope for Guaido. We hope
there
that,
is.
Yeah, okay, good. Well, let's talk about, we talked about the Jewish population in Venezuela, but how about the other Christians? It's mostly Catholic.
It is. According to the Pew Research, did a really extensive study of Latin American Christianity and religion in general in 2013, early 2014. They released in November, I think, 2014. And so the numbers are a little bit dated now, but it was nevertheless a good study. It missed a few things. But they estimated at that time that Venezuela's population was about 73% Catholic and about 17% Protestant, with the other 10% made up of various of other things, atheists and, et cetera. Today, the evangelical population is probably, it's estimated to be closer to 20%. It's been 5 years since the report came out. And a lot of that growth is at the expense of Catholicism. And so I've been talking a lot to Venezuela's evangelical leaders and faith leaders in general. I'm going to have an article coming out with Samuel Olson sometime this week on Providence's website. Samuel Olson doesn't sound like a very Latino name.
No, it doesn't. I was surprised when I read that.
That's right.
He's the evangelical sort of leader in Venezuela.
Yeah, he's got a megachurch in Caracas.
Samuel Olson.
Olson, yes. He is very Scandinavian, as the name sounds, which I love because my mother's side of the family are 100% Swede, so it endeared me to him. His parents came in 1947 from Sweden as missionaries, evangelical missionaries.
Oh, how interesting.
And he was born in 1942, so he's about 77 now. But he is very Venezolano. He's completely Venezuelan. But nevertheless, his name is not Perez or Diaz. It's Olson. But he is the president of the Venezuelan Evangelical Council, I believe it's called, Evangelical Council of Venezuela, and has been a prominent leader there since the 60s. Very much in leadership roles throughout the world with the World Evangelical Association, very well known across Latin America for his faith role, and known interfaith-wise. He's good friends with Rabbi Brenner. He's close friends with Cardinal Baltazar Porras in the Roman Catholic Church, etc.
And you describe you have observed a spiritual revival going on there.
Yes. One of the silver linings to the complete devastation that has hit Venezuela is the country, especially the poor and the common people that have no recourse to anything else, and they feel completely victimized with their backs against the wall. They've got really no choice but to pray. And so you have a lot of these people that are seeing God move in their lives in ways that they didn't when they were healthy and happy and everything was good.
Yeah, so God does not waste tragedy ever.
No.
For people that have ears to hear.
So a lot of people are going to churches, a lot of people are praying more, a lot of people are just being more aware of the role of God in their life, their life individually and the life of their country.
In terms of Catholics, I thought this was fascinating, Paul, that the priests in Venezuela are staunchly, at least overtly, it seems, anti-Maduro and pro-Guaido.
Not all of them, but many of them.
And the Pope, though, is kind of trying to straddle the middle and has let his leftist politics sort of have him de facto support Maduro. He doesn't say that openly, but that's really what's happened, isn't it?
It does appear that way. I mean, he has not condemned Maduro's horrific human rights abuses, just like he has not condemned the Castros. You know, he has you definitely get the vibe that his personal ideological predilections have impacted his public statements. And this is in stark contrast to John Paul II, who called out communist totalitarianism in Eastern Europe, but also any sort of authoritarianism he saw anywhere in the world. Whereas Francis has allowed himself to get photographed with Raul Castro and the regime there, et cetera. Very different vibe. And that has been really frustrating, I think, for a lot of Christian leaders in Venezuela, especially Roman Catholic hierarchy there.
So all of that to say about Venezuela, we need to continue to pray for them, and we will.
Yes.
Paul, in your recent lecture that you did in Milan, out of which this book came, a part of it anyway, which is Sovereignty, Democracy, and Liberty. Let's go back to that whole issue of nationalism, because as you know, in the EU elections, the nationalists really, really had a tremendous victory. They did the Brexit Party, for one thing, out of 6 weeks old, came out of nowhere and took, 23 seats in the EU, something like that. And we saw the same thing in, I think, Italy? Did conservatives win? Australia?
Yes. Yeah, they won.
The nationalists have won.
The Italian anti-EU group did quite well.
Yeah, and then others, too, who I get off the top of my head, I can't recall, but it was a pretty good victory for the nationalists. So explain to us then, Katie Hopkins, who's from Great Britain, said to me last week in an interview, she said, you know, we look to President Trump and America for this resurgence of nationalism. Why is that a good thing? Because, as you know, the left uses this as that we're Nazis if we are nationalists. Mm-hmm. So please explain, sir, why that's not true.
Thank you for the opportunity to do that. It's a good thing if we shape a moderate and healthy form of nationalism. It is true that there can be a version of nationalism that can be virulent, that can seek domination over others. We know this because that's in human nature. That's in all of us. So we know that nations can likewise do that. But it's not love of nation per se that does that as a phenomenon. The nationalism and national identity, is important to human thriving. And it's a good that people prize deeply. And when you take their identity away from them, that's actually more important to them, who they are and where they fit in the world, than food, drink, et cetera, et cetera.
Can I just interject something there, Paul? I was just thinking as you're saying that, just you think of people that are adopted. And they grow up in a wonderful family, maybe. Mm-hmm. Let's say they do, and they have great parents. But there's something in them that longs to know, who am I really?
Right, that's
natural. Who are my real parents? And I think, you know, family, this is my mother, my father, and this is who I am, and this is my DNA, mm-hmm. and this is my place. You're right. It's family, and country mm-hmm. is family.
Yes,
country is
exactly
an extension
right.
of family.
That's exactly right. It is an extension of family. So it's not, country is not just, in my view, a contractual relationship. It's a covenant that you have with fellow members of your country. And so one of the many arguments that I make in favor of a healthy version of nationalism is that nationalism can be and should be a moral. The phrase is skipping my mind right now, but I wrote this in the NDU publication I've got coming out this summer. It's a place where people can progress and advance morally. What I mean by that specifically is, you have a nation such as the United States. We have people of all creeds, colors, et cetera, that are here, but we're all American because we all, or most of us at least, adhere to the principles of the founders.
Half of us now.
I'm going to be an optimist and say that those principles are grounded deeply in our society and our culture. We just need to teach them more in our schools. Education is a whole other discussion. But we have that sense of being an American binds us all together and gives us moral obligations to each other. That's a good thing, not a bad thing. So in that sense, nationalism, quote unquote, is a very good thing. It gives us obligations to care for those that, you know, that would we normally would have think that we would have nothing in common with if that person were transplanted into a different country. We would have no bonds to bind us aside from the fact we're both members of the human race, which is an important bond. But,
well, how did the Europeans respond to that? Did you have Q&A or anything like
Not in the session because there were hundreds of people there, but I had people approach me afterward. And luckily, I think I did well enough in my discussion of why I'm not supporting fascism and why I'm supporting a healthy, moderate version of nationalism that brings people together and that gives people an identity that allows people, therefore, to interact with other nations on an equal basis and sovereign basis. That was a very positive vision. And so it was received quite positively.
So how your own personal view then of the European Union, which has really fought against that natural instinct? You know, let's blend all of our countries.
It didn't always.
No, I know, but I don't. I mean, I don't. I know what I think, but I want to know what you think about the European Union trying to blend Italians, French, Germans into one collective, one.
And we're all just Europeans.
No
they
borders.
Say. Right.
Yeah, we're all just Europeans.
Well,
yay,
I would,
Europe.
I would point to a speech that Margaret Thatcher gave in late August or September 1988 in Bruges, in Belgium. And very, very good speech where she talks about the EU and what it was becoming. And she warns against the trajectory that she saw it beginning to take then. And she says, basically, I'm going to paraphrase because I don't remember exact wording, but she said, just at the time when we see the Soviet Union having severe troubles, again, this is August, September 1988, and we see that the communist world is running away from centralism and embracing, to a certain degree, more individual identities, national sovereignty, et cetera. At that point, we do not need in the West to create a United States of Europe that seeks to get rid of all individual European identities and seeks to create an identikit personality that's European with a huge overarching, overweening, unaccountable state, European superstate in Brussels. She said, we're replicating what we have been decrying for decades in the part of the Soviet Union. Why are we doing this? She said, Europe will be stronger precisely because the French are French, the British are British, the Germans are Germans. And we each bring something, she says, unique to this mix of what it means to be European.
I love that. And I think that's, I haven't heard Margaret say that, but she must have heard me talking. I'm kidding. No, I mean, no wonder I like Margaret Thatcher. I mean, that's common sense. And families are the backbone of society, any society. And we maintain our family identity, but then we build a community.
Exactly.
And we build a
and
nation.
And you can't love the people outside of your family unless you first love the people in your family.
Right. And you want your other family and neighbors to love their families. There's
exactly.
not a threat to you to have them do that.
Then you know they're trustworthy members of society.
There
right?
you go, Paul. Honestly, so this will this be in English?
It is in English. Actually, most of the book is in Italian. My chapter is in English.
All right, we'll put a link to our Facebook page, Sovereignty, Democracy, and Liberty. Paul Collier, Dr. Paul Collier, thank you so much. We
thank
appreciate you,
you
coming in. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.